purple red as bone marrow, splattering and dripping everywhere. "I'll fetch Jamie," he croaked. "No!" I seized him by the sleeve with more strength than I would have imagined I possessed. "God, no! I don't want him to see me like this." His momentary silence told me, but I kept stubborn hold of his sleeve, unable to think how else to prevent the unthinkable. I blinked, water sliding over my face like a stream over rock, and Roger wavered once more into visibility, blurred around the edges.
He's seen you, Roger said gruffly.
He looked down, not wanting to meet my eyes.
It's already.
He waved a hand vaguely in the vicinity of his own black locks.
He saw it.
He did. This was nearly as much a shock as the initial discovery.
What did he say?
He took a deep breath and looked back up, like someone fearing to see a Gorgon. Or the anti-Gorgon, I thought bitterly.
He didn't see anything, Roger said, quite gently,
and put a hand on my arm.
He just cried.
I was still crying, too, but in a more orthodox fashion now, less of the gasping note. The sense of bone-deep cold had passed, and my limbs felt warm now, though I still felt a disconcertingly chilly breeze on my scalp. My heart was slowing again, and a faint sense that I was standing outside my body came over me. Shock, I thought, dimly surprised as the word formed itself in my mind, rubbery and melting. I supposed that one could suffer true physical shock as the result of emotional wounds.
Of course one could. I knew that. Claire.
I became aware that Roger was calling my name with increasing urgency and shaking my arm. With immense effort, I brought my eyes to focus on him. He was looking truly alarmed, and I wondered, vaguely, whether I had started to die again. But no, it was too late for that.
What?
He sighed, with relief, I thought.
You looked funny for a moment.
His voice was cracked and husky. He sounded as though it hurt him to talk.
I thought... Do you want another drink of water?
The suggestion seemed so incongruous that I nearly laughed. But I was terribly thirsty, and all at once a cup of cold water seemed the most desirable thing in the world.
Yes.
The tears continued to flow down my face, but now seemed almost soothing. I made no attempt to stop them. That seemed much too difficult, but blotted my face with a corner of the damp sheet. It was beginning to dawn on me that I might not have made the wisest, or at least not the easiest, choice when I decided not to die. Things outside the limits and concerns of my own body were starting to come back. Troubles, difficulties, dangers, sorrow. Dark, frightening things like a swarm of bats. I didn't want to look too closely at the images that lay in a disorderly pile at the bottom of my brain. Things I had jettisoned in the struggle to stay afloat. But if I had come back, I had come back to be what I was. And I was a doctor.
The sickness?
I blotted the last of the tears and let Roger wrap his hands around mine, helping me to hold the new cup.
Is it still...
No. He spoke gently and guided the rim of the cup to my lips.
What was it?
I wondered vaguely.
Water, but with something in it. Mint and something stronger, more bitter.
Angelica.
It stopped.
Roger held the cup, letting me sip slowly.
No one's fallen sick in the last week.
A week? I bobbled the cup, spilling a little down my chin.
How long have I...
Just about that.
He cleared his throat. Roger's eyes were intent on the cup. He skimmed a thumb lightly along my chin, removing the drops I had spilled.
You were among the last to fall sick.
I took a long breath, then drank a bit more. The liquid had a soft, sweet taste, too, floating over the bitter tang.
Honey.
My mind located the word, and I felt a sense of relief at having located this small, missing piece of reality. I knew from his manner that some of the sick had died, but asked no more for the moment. Deciding to live was one thing. Rejoining the world of the living was a struggle that would take strength I didn't have right now. I had pulled up my roots and lay like a wilted plant. Sinking them back into the earth was beyond me for the moment. The knowledge that people I knew, perhaps had loved, had died, seemed an equal grief to the loss of my hair, and either was more than I could cope with. I drank two further cups of honey-sweetened water, despite the underlying bitterness, then lay back with a sigh, my stomach feeling like a small, cold balloon.
"You want to take a bit of rest?"
Roger advised me, putting down the cup on the table.
"I'll fetch Brianna, aye? But you sleep if you want to."
I hadn't strength to nod, but managed a twitch of the lips that seemed to pass muster as a smile. I reached up a trembling hand and brushed it gingerly over the top of my shorn head. Roger flinched very slightly. He rose, and I saw how thin and strained he looked. He would have been helping tend the sick all week, I supposed. Not only me.
And bury the dead. He was licensed to conduct funerals.
Roger. It was a terrible effort to speak, so terribly hard to find the words, separate them from the tangle in my head.
Have you eaten anything recently?
His face changed then, a look of relief lightening the lines of strain and worry.
No,
he said, cleared his throat again and smiled.
Not since last night.
Oh. Well,
I said, and lifted one hand, heavy as lead.
Do get something, won't you?
Yes, he said. I will.
Instead of leaving, though, he hesitated, then took several rapid strides back, bent over the bed, and, seizing my face between his palms, kissed me on the forehead.
You're beautiful,
he said fiercely, and with a final squeeze of my cheeks, left.
What?
I said faintly, but the only answer was the bellying of the curtain as the breeze came in, scented with apples. In point of fact, I looked like a skeleton with a particularly unflattering crew cut, as I learned when I finally gained sufficient strength as to force Jamie to bring me a looking-glass.
"A dinner suppose you'd think of wearing a cap,"
he suggested diffidently, fingering a muslin specimen that Marsali had brought me.
"Only until it grows out a bit."
"I don't suppose I bloody would."
I had some difficulty in saying this, shocked as I was by the horrifying vision in the glass. In fact, I had a strong impulse to seize the cap from his hands, put it on, and pull it down to my shoulders. I had rejected earlier offers of a cap from Mrs. Bug, who had been volubly congratulating herself on my survival as the obvious result of her fever treatment, and from Masali, Malva, and every other woman who'd come to visit me. This was simple contrariness on my part. The sight of my unrestrained hair outraged their Scottish sense of what was proper in a woman, and they'd been trying, with varying degrees of subtlety, to force me into a cap for years. I was damned if I'd let circumstance accomplish it for them. Having now seen myself in a mirror, I felt somewhat less adamant about it, and my scalped head did feel a bit chilly. On the other hand, I realized that if I were to give in, Jamie would be terribly alarmed, and I thought I'd frightened him quite enough, judging by the hollow look of his face and the deep smudges under his eyes. As it was, his face had lightened considerably when I rejected the cap he was holding, and he tossed it aside. I carefully turned the looking-glass over and set it on the counterpane, repressing a sigh.
Always good for a laugh, I suppose, seeing the expressions on people's faces when they catch sight of me.
Jamie glanced at me, the corner of his mouth twitching.
You're very beautiful, Sassenach, he said gently.
Then he burst out laughing, snorting through his nose and wheezing. I raised one eyebrow at him, picked up the glass, and looked again, which made him laugh harder.
I leaned back against the pillows, feeling a bit better. The fever had quite gone, but I still felt wraith-like and weak, barely able to sit up unassisted, and I fell asleep almost without warning after the least exertion. Jamie, still snorting, took my hand, raised it to his mouth, and kissed it. The sudden warm intimacy of the touch rippled the fair hairs of my forearm, and my fingers closed involuntarily on his.
"I love you," he said, very softly, his shoulders still trembling with laughter.
"Oh," I said, suddenly feeling quite a lot better.
"Well, then, I love you too.
And it will grow, after all."
"So it will."
He kissed my hand again and set it gently on the quilt.
"Have you eaten?"
"A bit," I said, with what forbearance I could muster. "I'll have more later."
I had realized many years before why patients are called that. It's because a sick person is generally incapacitated, and thus obliged to put up with any amount of harassment and annoyance from persons who are not sick. The fever had broken, and I had regained consciousness 2 days before. Since then, the invariable response of everyone who saw me was to gasp at my appearance, urge me to wear a cap, and then try to force food down my throat. Jamie, more sensitive to my tones of voice than were Mrs. Bug, Malva, Brianna, or Masali, wisely desisted after a quick glance at the tray by the bed to see that I actually had eaten something.
"Tell me what's happened," I said, settling and bracing myself. "Who's been ill? How are they? And who..."
I cleared my throat.
"Who's died?"
He narrowed his eyes at me, obviously trying to guess whether I would faint, die, or leap out of the bed if he told me.
"You're sure you feel well enough, Sassenach?"
he asked dubiously.
"It's news that will not spoil with keeping."
"No, but I have to hear sooner or later, don't I? And knowing is better than worrying about what I don't know."
He nodded, taking the point, and took a deep breath.
"Aye, then. Patrick and his daughter are well on the mend. Evan, he's lost his youngest, wee Bobby. And Grace is still ill. But Hugh and Caitlin didn't fall sick at all."
He swallowed and went on.
"Three of the fisher folk have died. There's maybe a dozen still ailing, but most are on the mend."
He knit his brows, considering.
"And then there's Tom Christie. He's still bad, I hear."
"Is he?" Malva didn't mention it.
But then Malva had refused to tell me anything when I'd asked earlier, insisting that I must just rest and not worry myself.
"What about Alan?"
"No, he's fine," Jamie assured me.
"How long has Tom been sick?"
"I dinna ken. The lass can tell you."
I nodded, a mistake, as the light-headedness had not left me yet, and I was obliged to shut my eyes and let my head fall back, illuminated patterns flashing behind my lids.
"That's very odd,"
I said, a little breathlessly, hearing Jamie start up in response to my small collapse.
"When I close my eyes, often I see stars, but not like stars in the sky. They look just like the stars on the lining of a doll's suitcase. A portmanteau, I mean, that I had as a child. Why do you suppose that is?"
"I haven't got the slightest idea."
There was a rustle as he sat back down on the stool.
"You're no still delirious, are you?"
he asked dryly.
"Shouldn't think so."
"Was I delirious?"
Breathing deeply and carefully, I opened my eyes and gave him my best attempt at a smile.
"You were."
"Do I want to know what I said?"
The corner of his mouth twitched.
Probably not, but I may tell you sometime, anyway. I considered closing my eyes and floating off to sleep, rather than contemplate future embarrassments. But rallied. If I was going to live, and I was, I needed to gather up the strands of life that tethered me to the earth, and reattach them.
Bree's family, and Masali's, they're all right, I asked, only for form's sake.
Both Bree and Masali had come to hover anxiously over my prostrate form, and while neither one would tell me anything they thought might upset me in my weakened condition, I was reasonably sure that neither one could have kept it secret if the children were seriously ill.
"Aye," he said slowly. "Aye. They're fine."
"What?" I said, picking up the hesitation in his voice.
"They're fine," he repeated quickly.
"None of them has fallen ill at all." I gave him a cold look, though careful not to move too much while doing it.
"You may as well tell me," I said. "I'll get it out of Mrs. Bug if you don't."
As though mention of her name had invoked her, I heard the distinctive thump of Mrs. Bug's clogs on the stair, approaching. She was moving more slowly than usual, and with a care, suggesting that she was laden with something. This proved to be true. She negotiated sideways through the door, beaming, a loaded tray in one hand, the other wrapped round Henri Christian, who clung to her, monkey-like.
"I've brought you a wee bit to eat, Aliannon," she said briskly,
nudging the barely touched bowl of porridge and plate of cold toast aside to make room for the fresh provisions.
"You're no catching, are you?"
Barely waiting for my shake of the head, she leaned over the bed and gently decanted Henri Christian into my arms. Undiscriminatingly friendly as always, he butted his head under my chin, nuzzled into my chest, and began mouthing my knuckles, his sharp little baby teeth making small dents in my skin.
"Hello? What's happened here?"
I frowned, smoothing the soft brown licks of baby hair off his rounded brow, where the yellowing stain of an ugly bruise showed at his hairline.
"A spawn of a deal tried to kill the poor wean,"
Mrs. Bug informed me, mouth pulled tight.
"And would have done too, save for Roger Mac, bless him."
"Oh? Which spawn was this?" I asked, familiar with Mrs. Bug's methods of description.
"Some of the fisher's weans," Jamie said.
He put out a finger and touched Henri Christian's nose, snatched it away as the baby grabbed for it, then touched his nose again. Henri Christian giggled and grabbed his own nose, entranced by the game.
"The wicked creatures tried to drown him," Mrs. Bug amplified, "stole the poor wee laddie in his basket, and set him adrift in the creek."
"I shouldn't think they meant to drown him," Jamie said mildly, still absorbed in the game.
"If so, they wouldn't have trouble with the basket, surely."
"Hmm," was Mrs. Bug's response to this piece of logic.
"They didn't mean to do him any good," she added darkly.
I had been taking a quick inventory of Henri Christian's physique, finding several more healing bruises, a small scabbed cut on one heel, and a scraped knee.
"Well, you've been bumped about a bit, haven't you?" I said to him.
"Hmm. Hee-hee," said Henri Christian, vastly entertained by my explorations.
"Roger saved him?" I asked, glancing up at Jamie.
He nodded, one side of his mouth turning up a little.
"Aye. I didn't ken what was going on till wee Junie rushed up to me shouting as they'd taken her brother. But I got there in time to see the end of the matter."
The boys had set the baby's basket afloat in the trout pool, a wide, deep spot in the creek, where the water was fairly quiet. Made of stoutly woven reeds, the basket had floated, long enough for the current to push it toward the outfall from the pool, where the water ran swiftly through a stretch of rocks, before plunging over a 3-foot fall down into a tumbling churn of water and boulders. Roger had been building a rail fence within earshot of the creek. Hearing boys shouting and Félicité's steam whistle shrieks, he had dropped the rail he was holding and rushed down the hill, thinking that she was being tormented. Instead, he had burst from the trees just in time to see Henri Christian in his basket tip slowly over the edge of the outfall
and start bumping crazily from rock to rock, spinning in the current and taking on water. Running down the bank and launching himself in a flat dive, Roger had landed full length in the creek just below the fall, in time for Henri Christian, bawling with terror, to drop from his sodden basket, plummet down the fall, and land on Roger, who grabbed him.
"I was just in time to see it," Jamie informed me, grinning at the memory. "And then to see Roger Mac rise out of the water like a triton, with duckweed streaming from his hair, blood running from his nose, and the wee lad clutched tight in his arms. A terrible sight he was."
The miscreant boys had followed the basket's career, yelling along the banks, but were now struck dumb. One of them moved to flee, the others starting up like a flight of pigeons. But Roger had pointed an awful finger at them and bellowed, "Haas!" in a voice loud enough to be heard over the racket of the creek. Such was the force of his presence, they did stay, frozen in terror. Holding them with his glare, Roger had waded almost to the shore. There he squatted and cupped a handful of water which he poured over the head of the shrieking baby, who promptly quit shrieking.
"I baptize thee, Henri Christian," Roger had bellowed in his hoarse, cracked voice, "in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost. D'ye hear me, we bastards? His name is Christian. He belongs to the Lord. Trouble him again, ye lot of scabs, and Satan will pop up and drag ye straight down screaming to hell."
He stabbed an accusing finger once more at the boys, who this time did break and run, scampering wildly into the brush, pushing and falling in their urge to escape. "Oh, dear," I said, torn between laughter and dismay. I looked down at Henri Christian, who had lately discovered the joys of thumb-sucking and was absorbed in further study of the art. "That must have been impressive."
"It impressed me, to be sure," Jamie said, still grinning. "I'd no notion Roger Mac had it in him to preach hellfire and damnation like that. The lad's a great roar to him, cracked voice and all. He'd have a good audience, did he do it for a gathering, aye?"
"Well, that explains what happened to his voice," I said. I wondered, "Do you think it was only mischief, though? Them putting the baby in the creek?"
"Oh, it was mischief, sure enough," he said,
and cupped a big hand gently round Henri Christian's head.
"Not just boys' mischief, though."
Jamie had caught one of the fleeing boys as they hurtled past him, grabbing him by the neck and quite literally scaring the piss out of the lad. Walking the boy firmly into the wood, he'd pinned him hard against a tree and demanded to know the meaning of this attempted murder. Trembling and blubbering, the boy had tried to excuse it, saying that they hadn't meant any harm to the wing, truly. They'd only wanted to see him float, for their parents all said he was demon-born, and everyone kent that those born of Satan floated, because the water would reject their wickedness. They'd taken the baby in his basket and put that into the water, because they were afraid to touch him, fearing his flesh would burn them.
"I told him I'd burn him myself," Jamie said with a certain grimness, "and did."
He'd then dismissed the smarting lad, with instructions to go home, change his breeks, and inform his confederates that they were expected in Jamie's study before supper to receive their own share of retribution, or else himself would be coming round to their houses after supper to thrash them before their parents' eyes. "Did they come?" I asked, fascinated. He gave me a look of surprise.
"Of course. They took their medicine, and then we went to the kitchen and had bread and honey.
I told Marsali to bring the wee lad,
and after we'd eaten, I took him on my knee and had them all come and touch him, just to see."
He smiled, lopsidedly.
"One of the lads asked me, was it true what Mr. Roger said about the wain belonging to the Lord? I told him I certainly wouldn't argue with Mr. Roger about that, but whoever else he belonged to, Henri Christian belongs to me as well, and best they should remember it."
His finger trailed slowly down Henri Christian's round, smooth cheek. The baby was nearly asleep now, heavy eyelids closing, a tiny, glistening thumb half in, half out of his mouth. "I'm sorry, I missed that," I said softly, so as not to wake him. He'd grown much warmer, as sleeping babies did, and heavy in the curve of my arm. Jamie saw that I was having difficulty holding him, and took him from me, handing him back to Mrs. Bug, who'd been bustling quietly round the room, tidying, all the while listening with approval to Jamie's account.
"Oh, 'twas something to see," she assured me in a whisper, patting Henri Christian's back as she took him. "And the lads all poking their fingers out to touch the bairnie's wee belly, ginger-like, as if they meant to prod a hot potato, and him squirming and giggling like a worm wi' the fits. The wicked little gomerel's eyes were big as sixpences."
"I imagine they were," I said, amused. "On the other hand," I remarked sotto voce to Jamie as she left with the baby, "if their parents think he's demon-born, and you're his grandfather..."
"Well, you're his granny, Sassnach," Jamie said dryly. "It might be you. But I'd prefer not to have them dwell on that aspect of the matter."
"No," I agreed. Do any of them know, do you think, that Massali isn't your daughter by blood? They must know about Fergus."
"It wouldn't have much matter," he said. "They think we Henri's a changeling in any case."
"How do you know that?"
"People talk," he said briefly. "Are you feeling well in yourself, Sassnach?"
Relieved of the baby's weight, I had put back the covers a bit to let in air. Jamie stared at me in disapproval.
"Christ, I can count all your ribs right through your shift."
"Enjoy the experience while you can," I advised him tartly, though I felt a sharp pang of hurt. He seemed to sense this, for he took my hand, tracing the lines of the deep blue veins that ran across the back of it.
"Dinna fash yourself, Sassnach," he said, more gently. "I didn't mean it that way. Here, Mrs. Bugs brought you something tasty, I expect."
He lifted the lid off a small covered dish, frowned at the substance in it, then stuck a cautious finger in and licked it.
"Maple pudding," he announced, looking happy.
"Oh."
I had no appetite at all yet,
but maple pudding sounded at least innocuous, and I made no objection as he scooped up a spoonful, guiding it toward my mouth with the concentration of a man flying an airliner.
"I can feed myself, you know."
He slipped the spoon between my lips, and I resignedly sucked the pudding off it. Amazing revelations of creamy sweetness immediately exploded in my mouth, and I closed my eyes in minor ecstasy, recalling. "Oh, God," I said. "I'd forgotten what good food tastes like."
"I knew you hadn't been eating," he said with satisfaction. "Here, have more."
I insisted upon taking the spoon myself and managed half the dish. Jamie ate the other half at my urging.
"You may not be as thin as I am," I said, turning my hand over and grimacing at the sight of my protruding wrist bones, "but you haven't been eating a lot either." "I suppose not."
He scraped the spoon carefully round the bowl, retrieving the last bits of pudding, and sucked the spoon clean.
"It's been busy."
I watched him narrowly. He was being patently cheerful, but my rusty sensibilities were beginning to come back. For some unknowable span of time, I'd had neither energy nor attention for anything that lay outside the fever-racked shell of my body. Now, I was seeing the small familiarities of Jamie's body, voice and manner, and becoming reattuned to him, like a slack violin string being tightened in the presence of a tuning fork. I could feel the vibration of some strain in him, and I was beginning to think it wasn't all due to my recent near demise.
"What?" I said. "What?"
He raised his eyebrows in question, but I knew him too well for that. The question alone gave me confidence that I was right.
"What aren't you telling me?" I asked with what patience I could muster. "Is it Brown again? Have you got news of Stephen Bonnet? Or Donna? Or has the white sow eaten one of the children and choked to death?" That made him smile at least, though only for a moment.
"Not that," he said. "She went for a MacDonald when he called a few days ago, but he made it onto the porch in time. Very agile, the Major is, for a man of his age."
"He's younger than you are," I objected.
"Well, I'm agile too," he said logically. "The sow hasn't got me yet, has she?"
I felt a qualm of unease at his mention of the Major, but it wasn't news of political unrest or military rumblings that was troubling Jamie. He would have told me that at once. I narrowed my eyes at him again, but didn't speak. He sighed deeply.
"I am thinking I must send them away,"
he said quietly, and took my hand again. "Send who away?"
"Fergus and Massali and the Waynes."
I felt a sharp, sudden jolt as though someone had struck me just below the breastbone, and found it suddenly difficult to draw breath.
"What? Why? And where?"
I managed to ask. He rubbed his thumb lightly over my knuckles, back and forth, his eyes focused on the small motion.
"Fergus tried to kill himself 3 days ago," he said very quietly.
My hand gripped his convulsively.
"Holy God," I whispered.
He nodded, and I saw that he was unable to speak for the moment. His teeth were set in his lower lip. Now it was I who took his hand in both of mine, feeling coldness seep through my flesh. I wanted to deny it, reject the notion utterly, but couldn't. It sat there between us, an ugly thing, like a poisonous toad that neither of us wished to touch.
"How?"
I said at last. My voice seemed to echo in the room. I wanted to say, "Are you sure?" But I knew he was.
"With a knife,"
he replied literally. The corner of his mouth twitched again, but not with humour.
"He said he would have hanged himself, but he couldn't tie the rope with one hand. Lucky that."
The pudding had formed a small, hard ball, like rubber, that lay in the bottom of my stomach.
"You found him? Or was it Massali?"
He shook his head.
"She doesn't ken. Or rather, I expect she does, but she's no admitting it to either of them."
"He can't have been badly wounded then, or she'd have to know for sure."
My chest still hurt, but the words were coming more easily.
"No. I saw him go past whilst I was scraping a deer's hide up on the hill. He didn't see me, and I didn't call out. I didn't ken what it was that struck me queer about him, but something did. I went on with my work for a bit. I didn't want to go far from the house in case, but it niggled at me."
He let go of my hand and rubbed his knuckles underneath his nose.
"I couldn't seem to let go of the thought that something was amiss. And finally I put down my work and went after him, thinking myself all kinds of a fool for it."
Fergus had headed over the end of the ridge and down the wooded slope that led to the White Spring. This was the most remote and secluded of the three springs on the ridge, called White, because of the large pale boulder that stood near the head of the pool. Jamie had come down through the trees in time to see Fergus lie down by the spring, sleeve rolled up, and coat folded beneath his head, and submerge his handless left arm in the water.
"I should maybe have shouted then," he said, rubbing a distracted hand through his hair. "But I couldn't really believe it, Ken."
Then Fergus had taken a small boning knife in his right hand, reached down into the pool, and neatly opened the veins of his left elbow, blood blooming in a soft, dark cloud around the whiteness of his arm.
"I shouted then," Jamie said.
He closed his eyes and scrubbed his hands hard over his face as though trying to erase the memory of it. He had run down the hill, grabbed Fergus, jerked him to his feet, and hit him.
"You hit him?"
"I did," he said shortly. "He's lucky I didn't break his neck, the wee bastard."
Colour had begun to rise in his face as he talked, and he pressed his lips tight together. "Was this after the boys took Henri Christian?" I asked, my memory of the conversation in the stable with Fergus vividly in mind.
"I mean..." "Aye, I ken what you mean," he interrupted. "And it was the day after the lads put Henri Christian in the creek, aye. It was not only that, though. Not only all the trouble over the wee laddie being a dwarf, I mean."
He glanced at me, his face troubled.
We'd talked, after I'd bound up his arm and brought him round. He said he'd been thinking of it for some time. The thing with the bairn only pushed him into it.
But how could he? I said, distressed. To leave Massali and the children, how?
Jamie looked down, hands braced on his knees, and sighed. The window was open, and a soft breeze came in, lifting the hairs on the crown of his head like tiny flames.
He thought they would do better without him, he said flatly. If he was dead, Massali could wed again, find a man who could care for her and the Waynes, provide for them, protect Wee Henri.
He thinks, thought, he couldn't?
Jamie glanced sharply at me.
Sassenach, he said. He kens damn well he can't.
I drew breath to protest this, but bit my lip instead, finding no immediate rebuttal. Jamie stood up and moved restlessly about the room, picking things up and putting them down.
Would you do such a thing? I asked, after a bit.
In the same circumstances, I mean. He paused for a moment, his back to me, hand on my hairbrush.
No, he said softly, but it's a hard thing for a man to live with.
Well, I see that, I began slowly.
But he swung round to face me. His own face was strained, filled with a weariness that had little to do with lack of sleep.
No, Sassenach, he said. You don't.
He spoke gently, but with such a tone of despair in his voice that tears came to my eyes. It was as much sheer physical weakness as emotional distress. But I knew that if I gave way to it, the end would be complete soggy disintegration. And no one needed that just now. I bit my lip hard and wiped my eyes with the edge of the sheet. I heard the thump as he knelt down beside me, and I reached out blindly for him, pulling his head against my breast. He put his arms round me and sighed deeply, his breath warm on my skin through the linen of my shift. I stroked his hair with one trembling hand, and felt him give way suddenly, all the tension going out of him like water running from a jug.
I had the oddest feeling then, as though the strength he had clung to had now been let go, and was flowing into me.
My tenuous grip on my own body firmed as I held his, and my heart ceased wavering, taking up instead its normal, solid, tireless beating. The tears had retreated, though they were precariously near the surface. I traced the lines of his face with my fingers, ruddy bronze and lined with sun and care. The high forehead, with its thick auburn brows, and the broad planes of his cheek, the long straight nose straight as a blade. The closed eyes, slanted and mysterious, with those odd lashes of his, blonde at the root, so deep and auburn at the tips as to seem almost black.
"Don't you know?" I said, very softly, tracing the small, neat line of his ear. Tiny, stiff blonde hairs sprouted in a tiny whorl from the tagus, tickling my finger. "Don't any of you know that it's you? Not that what you can give or do or provide. Just you."
He took a deep, shuddering breath and nodded, though he didn't open his eyes.
"I know. I said that to him, to Fergus," he said, very softly. "Or at least I think I did. I said a terrible lot of things."
They had knelt together by the spring, embracing, wet with blood and water, locked together as though he could hold Fergus to the earth, to his family, by force of will alone, and he had no notion at all what he had said, lost in the passion of the moment, until the end.
"You must continue, for their sakes, though you would not for your own," he had whispered.
Fergus's face pressed into his shoulder, the black hair wet with sweat and water, cold against his cheek.
"Tu comprends, mon enfant, mon fils. Comprends-toi."
I felt his throat move as he swallowed.
"See, I kent you were dying," he said, very softly. I was sure you'd be gone when I came back to the house. And I should be alone.
I wasn't speaking to Fergus then, I think, so much as to myself.
He raised his head then and looked at me through a blur of tears and laughter.
Oh, God, Claire, he said. I would have been so angry if you'd died and left me.
I wanted to laugh or cry or both myself. And had I still harboured regrets regarding the loss of eternal peace, I would have surrendered them now without hesitation.
I didn't, I said, and touched his lip. I won't. Or at least, I'll try not.
I slid my hand behind his head and drew him back to me. He was a good deal larger and heavier than Henri Christian, but I felt I could hold him forever, if necessary. It was early afternoon, and the light just beginning to shift, slanting in through the tops of the west-facing windows, so that the room filled with a clean, bright light that glowed on Jamie's hair and the worn, creamy linen of his shirt. I could feel the knobs at the top of his spine and the yielding flesh in the narrow channel between shoulder blade and backbone.
"Where will you send them?" I asked, and tried to smooth the whorled hair of the cowlick on his crown.
"To Cross Creek, maybe. Or to Wilmington," he replied.
His eyes were half-closed, watching the shadows of leaves flicker on the side of the armoire he had built me.
"Whatever seems best for the printing trade."
He shifted a little, tightening his grip on my buttocks, then frowned.
"Christ, Sassenach, you haven't got any bum left at all."
"Well, never mind," I said with resignation. "I'm sure that will grow back soon enough."
Chapter 65. Moment of Declaration. Jamie met them near Woolham's Mill, five men on horseback. Two were strangers. Two were men from Salisbury, that he knew. Ex-regulators named Green and Whery. Avid Whigs. The last was Richard Brown, whose face was cold, save for his eyes. He silently cursed his love of conversation. If not for that, he would have parted from MacDonald, as usual, at Coopersville. But they'd been talking of poetry. Poetry, for God's sake. And amusing each other in declamation. Now, here he stood in the empty road, holding two horses, while MacDonald, whose guts were in disagreement with him, busied himself deep in the wood. Amos Green tipped him a nod, and would have passed, but Kitmund Wherry reined up. The strangers did likewise, staring curiously.
"Where art thou bound, friend James?" Wherry, a Quaker, asked pleasantly. "Does thee come to the meeting at Halifax? For thee is welcome to ride with us, and that be so." Halifax.
He felt a trickle of sweat run down the crease of his back. The meeting of the Committee of Correspondence to elect delegates to the Continental Congress.
"I'm seeing a friend upon his road," he replied courteously, with a nod toward MacDonald's horse. "I will follow, though. Perhaps I shall catch ye up along the way." "Fat chance of that," he thought, carefully not looking at Brown. "I'd not be so sure of your welcome, Mr. Fraser."
Green spoke civilly enough, but with a certain coldness in his manner that made Wherry glance at him in surprise.
"Not after what happened in Cross Creek." "Oh, and would you see an innocent man burnt alive or tarred and feathered?"
The last thing he wished was an argument, but something must be said. One of the strangers spat in the road.
"Not so innocent, if that's Fogarty Sims you're speaking of. Little Tory pissant," he added, as an afterthought. "That's the fellow," Green said, and spat in agreement. "The committee in Cross Creek set out to teach him a lesson. Seems Mr. Fraser here was in disagreement. Quite a scene it was from what I hear," he drawled, leaning back a little in his saddle to survey Jamie from his superior height. "Like I said, Mr. Fraser, you ain't all that popular right this minute."
Wherry was frowning, glancing to and fro between Jamie and Green.
"To save a man from tar and feathers, no matter what his politics, seems no more than common humanity," he said sharply.
Brown laughed unpleasantly.
Might seem so to you, I reckon. Not to other folk. You know a man by the company he keeps. And beyond that, there's your auntie, eh? He said, redirecting his speech to Jamie. And the famous Mrs. MacDonald. I read that speech she gave in the final edition of Sims's newspaper, he added, repeating the unpleasant laugh.
My aunt's guests have naught to do with me,
Jamie said, striving for simple matter-of-factness. No. How about your aunt's husband? Your uncle, would he be?
Duncan.
His incredulity plainly showed in his voice, for the strangers exchanged glances, and their manner relaxed a little.
No, he's my aunt's fourth husband.
And a friend. Why'd you speak of him?
Why, Duncan in his is cheek by jowl with Farquhar Campbell, and a good many other loyalists. The two of them have been putting money enough to float a ship into pamphlets preaching reconciliation with Mother England. Surprised you didn't know that, Mr. Fraser.
Jamie wasn't merely surprised, but thunderstruck at this revelation, but hid it.
A man's opinions are his own, he said with a shrug. Duncan must do as he likes, and I shall do the same.
Wherry was nodding agreement with this, but the others were regarding him with expressions ranging from scepticism to hostility. Wherry was not unaware of his companion's responses.
"What is thy opinion, then, friend?"
he asked politely.
"Well, he'd known it was coming. Had now and then tried to imagine the circumstances of his declaration, in situations ranging from the vaingloriously heroic to the openly dangerous. But, as usual in such matters, God's sense of humour trumped all imagination.
And so he found himself taking that final step into irrevocable and public commitment to the rebel cause, just incidentally being required to ally himself with a deadly enemy in the process, standing alone in a dusty road, with a uniformed officer of the Crown squatting in the bushes directly behind him, breeches round his ankles.
"I am for liberty," he said,
in a tone indicating mild astonishment that there could be any question regarding his position.
"Are you so?"
Green looked hard at him, then lifted his chin in the direction of MacDonald's horse, where MacDonald's regimental sword hung from the saddle, gilt and tassels gleaming in the sun.
"How come you to be in company with the redcoat, then?"
"He's a friend," Jamie replied evenly.
"A redcoat?"
One of the strangers reared back in his saddle as though stung by a bee.
"How come redcoats here?"
The man sounded flabbergasted, and looked hastily to and fro as though expecting a company of the creatures to burst from the wood, muskets firing.
"Only the one, so far as I know," Brown assured him. "Name's MacDonald. He's not a real soldier. Retired on half pay. Works for the governor."
His companion didn't seem noticeably reassured.
"What are you doing with this MacDonald?" he demanded of Jamie.
"As I said, he is a friend." The attitude of the men had changed in an instant, from scepticism and mild hostility to open offence.
"He's the governor's spy, is what he is," Green declared flatly.
This was no more than the truth, and Jamie was reasonably sure that half the back country knew it. MacDonald made no effort to hide either his appearance nor his errands. To deny the fact was to ask them to believe Jamie a dunce, duplicitous, or both. There was a stirring among the men now, glances exchanged, and the smallest of motions, hands touching knife hilts and pistol grips.
"Very fine," Jamie thought, not satisfied with the irony of the situation. God had now decided that he should fight to the death against the allies he had declared himself to moments earlier, in defence of an officer of the Crown he had just declared himself against.
As his son-in-law was fond of remarking,
"Great." "Bring him out," Brown ordered, nudging his horse to the forefront. "We'll see what he has to say for himself, this friend of yours. And then, might be, we'll learn him a lesson he can carry back to the governor, eh?"
One of the strangers took off his hat and tucked it carefully beneath the edge of his saddle, preparing.
"Wait."
Wherry drew himself up, trying to quell them with a hand, though Jamie could have told him he was several minutes past the point where such an attempt might have had any effect.
"You cannot lay violent hands upon—" Can't we, though?
Brown grinned like a death's head, eyes fixed on Jamie, and began to undo the leather quirt, coiled and fastened to his saddle.
No tar to hand, alas. But a good beating, say, and send them both squealing home to the governor, stark naked. That'd answer.
The second stranger laughed and spat again, so the gob landed juicily at Jamie's feet.
Aye, that'll do. Here you held off a mob by yourself in Cross Creek, Fraser. Only 5-2 now. How do you like them odds?
Jamie liked them fine. Dropping the reins he held, he turned and flung himself between the two horses, screeching and slapping hard at their flanks, then dived headlong into the brush at the roadside, scrabbling through roots and stones on hands and knees as fast as he could. Behind him, the horses were rearing and wheeling, whinnying loudly, and spreading confusion and fright through the other men's mounts. He could hear cries of anger and alarm as they tried to gain control of the plunging horses. He slid down a short slope, dirt and uprooted plants spraying up around his feet, lost his balance, and fell at the bottom, bounded up, and dashed into an oak copse, where he plastered himself behind a screen of saplings, breathing hard. Someone had had wit, or fury enough, to jump off his horse and follow on foot. He could hear crashing and cursing near at hand over the fainter cries of the commotion on the road. Glancing cautiously through the leaves, he saw Richard Brown, dishevelled and hatless, looking wildly round, pistol in hand. Any thought he might have had of confrontation vanished. He was unarmed, save a small knife in his stocking, and it was clear to him that Brown would shoot him instantly, claiming self-defence when the others eventually caught up. Up the slope, toward the road, he caught a glimpse of red. Brown, turning in the same direction, saw it too, and fired, whereupon Donald MacDonald, having thoughtfully hung up his coat in a tree, stepped out of cover behind Richard Brown in his shirt sleeves and hit Brown over the head with a solid length of tree branch. Brown fell on his knees, momentarily stunned, and Jamie slipped out of the copse, beckoning to MacDonald, who ran heavily to meet him. Together they made their way deeper into the forest, waited by a stream until prolonged silence from the road indicated that it might be safe to go back for a look. The men were gone, so was MacDonald's horse. Gideon, the whites of his eyes showing and ears laid flat, rolled back his upper lip and squealed fiercely at them, big yellow teeth bared and slobber flying. Brown and company had wisely thought twice about stealing a rabid horse, but had tied him up to a tree and managed to spoil his harness, which hung in bits around his neck. MacDonald's sword lay in the dust, torn from its scabbard, blade broken in two. MacDonald picked up the pieces, viewed them for a moment, then, shaking his head, tucked them through his belt.
"Do you think Jones could mend it?" he asked. "Or better to go down to Salisbury?"
"Wilmington or New Bern," Jamie said, wiping a hand across his mouth. "Die Jones has not the skill to mend a sword, but you'll find few friends in Salisbury from what I hear."
Salisbury had been at the heart of the regulation, and anti-government sentiment still ran high there. His own heart had gone back to its usual way of beating, but he still felt weak-kneed in the aftermath of flight and anger. MacDonald nodded bleakly, then glanced at Gideon.
"Is yon thing safe to ride?"
"No."
In Gideon's present state of agitation, Jamie wouldn't risk riding him alone, let alone double-mounted and with no bridle. They'd left the rope on his saddle, at least. He got a loop over the stallion's head without being bitten, and they set off without comment, returning to the ridge on foot.
"Very unfortunate," MacDonald observed thoughtfully at one point, "that they should have met us together. Do you think it's dished your chances of worming your way into their councils?" "I should give my left ball to have an eye and an ear in that meeting they spoke of. I'll tell you that for nothing."
With a dim sense of wonder, Jamie realised that having made his momentous declaration, overheard by the man whose cause he sought to betray, and then nearly killed by the new allies whose side he sought to uphold, neither side had believed him.
"Do you ever wonder what it sounds like when God laughs, Donald?" he asked thoughtfully. MacDonald pursed his lips and glanced at the horizon, where dark clouds swelled just beyond the shoulder of the mountain.
"Like thunder, I imagine," he said. "Do you not think so?"
Jamie shook his head.
"No, I think it's a very small wee sound indeed."
Chapter 66. The Dark Rises. I heard all the sound of the household below and the rumble of Jamie's voice outside and felt entirely peaceful. I was watching the sun shift and glow on the yellowing chestnut trees outside when the sound of feet came marching up the stairs, steady and determined. The door flung open and Brianna came in, wind-tousled and bright-faced, wearing a steely expression. She halted at the foot of my bed, levelled a long forefinger at me, and said, "You are not allowed to die."
"Oh," I said, blinking. "I didn't think I was going to."
"You tried," she said accusingly. "You know you did."
"Well, not to say tried exactly," I began weakly.
If I hadn't exactly tried to die, though, it was true that I hadn't quite tried not to, and I must have looked guilty, for our eyes narrowed into blue slits.
"Don't you dare do that again," she said, and wheeling in a sweep of blue cloak, stomped out, pausing at the door to say, "Because I love you and I can't do without you," in a strangled voice before running down the stairs.
"I love you too, darling," I called, the always ready tears coming to my eyes. But there was no reply, save the sound of the front door closing. Adso, drowsing in a puddle of sun on the counterpane at my feet, opened his eyes a fraction of an inch at the noise, then sank his head back into his shoulders, purring louder. I lay back on the pillow, feeling a good deal less peaceful, but somewhat more alive. A moment later I sat up, put back the quilts, and swung my legs out of bed. Adso abruptly quit purring. "Don't worry," I told him. "I'm not going to keel over. Your supply of milk and scraps is perfectly safe. Keep the bed warm for me." I had been up, of course, and even allowed on short, intensely supervised excursions outside. But no one had let me try to go anywhere alone since before I fell ill, and I was reasonably sure they wouldn't let me do it now. I therefore stole downstairs in stockinged feet, shoes in hand, and instead of going through the front door, whose hinges squeaked, or through the kitchen, where Mrs. Bug was working, I slipped into my surgery, opened the window, and, having checked to be sure the white sow wasn't hanging about below, climbed carefully out. I felt quite giddy at my escape, a rush of spirits that sustained me for a little way down the path. Thereafter I was obliged to stop every few hundred feet, sit down, and gasp a bit while my legs recovered their strength. I persevered, though, and at last came to the Christie cabin. No one was in sight, nor was there any response to my tentative, "Hello?" But when I knocked at the door, I heard Tom Christie's voice, gruff and dispirited, bid me enter. He was at the table, writing, but from the looks of him, ought still to have been in bed. His eyes widened in surprise at sight of me, and he hastily tried to straighten the grubby shawl round his shoulders.
"Mrs. Freezer, are you, that is, what in the name of God?"
Deprived of speech, he pointed at me, eyes round as saucers. I had taken off my broad-brimmed hat when I entered, forgetting momentarily that I looked like nothing so much as an excited bottle-brush.
"Oh,"
I said, passing a self-conscious hand over my head. "The hat. You ought to be pleased. I'm not going about outraging the public by a wanton display of my flowing locks."
"You look like a convict," he said bluntly. "Sit down."
I did, being rather in need of the stool he offered me, owing to the exertions of the walk. "How are you?" I inquired, peering at him. The light in the cabin was very bad. He had been writing with a candle and had put it out upon my appearance.
"How am I?"
He seemed both astonished and rather put out at the inquiry.
"You have walked all the way here, in a dangerously enfeebled condition, to ask after my health."
"If you care to put it that way," I replied,
rather nettled by that "dangerously enfeebled."
"I don't suppose you would care to step out into the light so that I can get a decent look at you, would you?"
He drew the ends of the shawl protectively across his chest.
"Why?"
He frowned at me, peaked brows drawing together so that he looked like an irritable owl.
"Because I want to know a few things regarding your state of health," I replied patiently.
"And examining you is likely the best way of finding them out, since you don't seem able to tell me anything."
"You are most unaccountable, madam."
"No, I am a doctor," I countered, "and I want to know."
A brief wave of giddiness came over me, and I leaned on the table, holding on till it passed.
"You are insane," he stated, having scrutinized me for a moment.
"You are also still ill, I believe. Stay there. I shall call my son to go and fetch your husband."
I flapped a hand at him and took a deep breath. My heart was racing, and I was a trifle pale and sweaty, but essentially all right.
"The fact of the matter, Mr. Christie, is that while I've certainly been ill, I wasn't ill with the same sickness that's been afflicting people on the ridge. And from what Malva was able to tell me, I don't think you were, either." He had risen to go and call Alan. At this he froze, staring at me with his mouth open. Then he slowly lowered himself back into his chair.
"What do you mean?"
Having finally got his attention, I was pleased to lay out the facts before him. I had them neatly to hand, having given them considerable thought over the last few days. While several families on the ridge had suffered the depredations of amoebic dysentery, I hadn't. I had had a dangerously high fever, accompanied by dreadful headache and, so far as I could tell from Malva's excited account, convulsions. But it certainly wasn't dysentery.
"Are you certain of this?"
He was twiddling his discarded quill, frowning. "It's rather hard to mistake bloody flux for headache and fever," I said tartly. "Now, did you have flux?"
He hesitated a moment, but curiosity got the better of him.
"No," he said. "It was, as you say, a headache fit to split the skull, and fever, a terrible weakness, and extraordinarily unpleasant dreams. I had no notion that it wasn't the same illness afflicting the others."
"No reason you should, I suppose. You didn't see any of them. Unless, did Malva describe the illness to you?"
I asked only from curiosity, but he shook his head.
"I do not wish to hear of such things. She does not tell me.
Still, why have you come?"
He tilted his head to one side, narrowing his eyes.
"What difference does it make whether you and I suffered an ague rather than a flux? Or anyone else, for that matter?"
He seemed rather agitated and got up, moving about the cabin in an unfocused, bumbling sort of way, quite unlike his usual decisive movements.
I sighed, rubbing a hand over my forehead. I'd got the basic information I came for. Explaining why I wanted it was going to be uphill work. I had enough trouble getting Jamie, young Ian, and Malva to accept the germ theory of disease, and that was with the evidence visible through a microscope to hand.
"Disease is catching," I said, a little tiredly.
"It passes from one person to another, sometimes directly, sometimes by means of food or water shared between a sick person and a healthy one. All of the people who had the flux live near a particular small spring. I have some reason to think that it was the water of that spring that carried the amoeba, that made them ill."
"You and I, though, I haven't seen you in weeks, nor have I been near anyone else who's had the ague. How is it that we should both fall ill of the same thing?"
He stared at me, baffled and still frowning.
"I do not see why two persons cannot fall ill without seeing each other. Certainly I have known such illnesses as you describe. Jail fever, for instance, spreads in close quarters. But surely not all illnesses behave in the same fashion.
No, they don't, I admitted. I wasn't in a fit state to try to get across the basic notions of epidemiology or public health either. It's possible, for instance, for some diseases to be spread by mosquitoes. Malaria, for one. Some forms of viral meningitis, for another. My best guess as to the illness I just recovered from. Do you recall being bitten by a mosquito any time recently? He stared at me, then uttered a brief sort of bark I took for laughter.
My dear woman, everyone in this festering climate is bitten repeatedly during the hot weather.
He scratched at his beard as though by reflex. That was true. Everyone but me and Roger.
Now and then some desperate insect would have a go, but for the most part we escaped unbitten, even when there were absolute plagues of the creatures, and everyone around us was scratching.
As a theory, I suspected that blood-drinking mosquitoes had evolved so closely with mankind through the years that Roger and I simply didn't smell right to them, having come from too far away in time. Brianna and Jemmy, who shared my genetic material but also Jamie's, were bitten, but not as frequently as most people. I didn't recall having been bitten any time recently, but it was possible that I had been, and had simply been too busy to notice.
"Why does it matter?"
Christy asked, seeming now nearly baffled. "I don't know. I just need to find things out." I'd also needed both to get away from the house and to make some move to reclaim my life by the most direct means I knew, the practice of medicine. But that wasn't anything I meant to share with Tom Christie.
"Hmm," he said.
He stood looking down at me, frowning and undecided. Then suddenly extended a hand, the one I had operated on, I saw. The Z of the incision had faded to a healthy pale pink, and the fingers lay straight.
"Come outside, then," he said resignedly. "I will see you home, and if you insist upon asking intrusive and bothersome questions regarding my health along the way, I suppose I cannot stop you."
Startled, I took his hand and found his grip solid and steady, despite the haggard look of his face and the slump of his shoulders. "You needn't walk me home," I protested. "You ought to be in bed by the looks of you."
"So should you," he said,
leading me to the door with a hand beneath my elbow.
"But if you choose to risk your health and your life by undertaking such inappropriate exertion, why, so can I. Though you must," he added sternly, "put on your hat before we go."
We made it back to the house, stopping frequently for rest, and arrived panting, dripping with sweat, and generally exhilarated by the adventure. No one had missed me, but Mr. Christie insisted upon delivering me inside, which meant that everyone observed my absence ex post facto, and in the irrational way of people at once became very annoyed. I was scolded by everyone in sight, including young Ian, frog-marched upstairs virtually by the scruff of the neck, and thrust forcibly back into bed, where I was given to understand I should be lucky to be given bread and milk to my supper. The most annoying aspect of the whole situation was Thomas Christie, standing at the foot of the stairs with a mug of beer in his hand, watching as I was led off, and wearing the only grin I had ever seen on his hairy face.
"What in the name of God possessed you, Sassenach?"
Jamie jerked back the quilt and gestured peremptorily at the sheets. "Well, I felt quite well, and..."
"Well? You're the colour of bad buttermilk, and trembling so you can scarcely..." "Here, let me do that."
Making snorting noises, he pushed my hands away from the laces of my petticoats, and had them off me in a trice.
"Have you lost your mind?" he demanded. "And to sneak off like that without telling anyone, too. What if you'd fallen? What if you got ill again?"
"If I told anyone, they wouldn't have let me go out," I said mildly. "And I am a physician, you know. Surely I can judge my own state of health." He gave me a look, strongly suggesting that he wouldn't trust me to judge a flower show, but merely gave a louder-than-usual snort in reply. He then picked me up bodily, carried me to the bed, and placed me gently into it, but with enough demonstration of restrained strength
as to let me know that he would have preferred to drop me from a height.
He then straightened up, giving me a baleful look. If you didn't look as though you were about to faint, Sassenach, I swear I would turn you over and smack your bum for you.
You can't, I said, rather faintly. I haven't got one.
I was, in fact, a little tired. Well, to be honest, my heart was beating like a kettle drum, my ears were ringing, and if I didn't lie down flat at once, I likely would faint. I did lie down, and lay with my eyes closed, feeling the room spin gently round me, like a merry-go-round, complete with flashing lights and hurdy-gurdy music. Through this confusion of sensations, I dimly sensed hands on my legs, then a pleasant coolness on my heated body. Then something warm and cloud-like enveloped my head, and I flailed my hands about